Oh, hey there, listeners and juicers. Before we get into today's episode, I wanted to let you know that if you have fallen in love with the Draw Your Dice podcast and want to help put some new fruit on the table, but don't feel comfortable making a monthly commitment, well, you can support the show via the Acast supporter feature. No gift too large, nor too small. Just click on the link in the show description and know that I am sending you the strongest hug when you do so.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
You don't need the fund at all. You can make an entire TTRPG on, like, essentially a $0 budget.
My name is Jeremy Gage, and welcome to the Draw Your Dice podcast. This is an educational show involving all things tabletop role-playing industry. Listen alongside me as we hear from creators, entrepreneurs, and supporters about their personal best practices, principles, and philosophies. I encourage anyone from the budding game designer to a seasoned publisher and everyone in between to sit down with us and enjoy today's episode. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Draw Your Dice podcast. My name is Jeremy Gage, as you heard in the intro. But as always, these episodes are never about me. It is about a very special guest I've brought to the show today. This guest is criminally underserved on the social media. You have, what, 19 followers on there right now for one of your accounts? And it is bullshit because we're going to talk about a really great game today using a lot of things that I wish more RPGs did. This guest is also the designer behind Revenant World Games. I would like to bring to the show Clove Fulminata.
Thank you. Great audience here tonight.
Clove, thank you so much for being here today. It is an absolute pleasure.
Thank you for having me. Yeah, I'm really excited to be on the show. Been listening for a while now. I think I've listened to almost every interview now. So yeah.
Oh well, thank you. Thank you very much. Why didn't you tell me that before we started? I'm stunned. Clove, as a thank you very much. As a brief start to this show, so we can get our wheels moving. Why don't you give a brief introduction of how you present yourself to the world and to the internet and. Please give any plugs or anything that you have. That way I can get you all the dollars as people listen to these episodes.
Sure. So yeah, my name's Clove Fulminata. I use they, them pronouns and also the neo pronouns pay, peer, pes. My studio is Vagabond Pen and Paper. Vagabondpenandpaper.itch.io is my itch page. You can find my Twitter at CloveRPG. And if you only want to see promotional tweets at Revenant World, which is that's the account that only has a dozen or so followers, but I've got a few more on the main account, so not doing too terrible. And yeah, I've been publishing tabletop role-playing games for a few years now. Started with Revenant World, and I just put out the sequel to Revenant World, Ar Minerva. So yeah, I think that's the juice.
Awesome. Additionally, as an extra icebreaker for listeners, would you kind of describe your sort of starting journey into the discipline, the hobby that is the tabletop game space, and could be video games too? And then what was maybe the first thing that got you into the groove of designing, being a game author? Would you take us through that?
Absolutely. So I had no exposure to tabletop RPGs at all until I was in college. And I would get lunch with a friend every once in a while. And one time they were talking about the D&D game that they had just started with a couple other friends, people we knew from high school. I thought it sounded really cool. And I was like, hey, how do I get in on this? So I was able to jump into their campaign of Lost Minds of Phandelver, the 5e starter kit. And we had a lot of fun with that. And some of the other folks recommended the Adventure Zone actual play podcast. And I had also, of course, never listened to an actual play podcast. So I checked that out. This is back when they were still in their first campaign playing D&D. But towards the end of that campaign, they do a little arc where Griffin McElroy put together this like very simple Power by the Apocalypse hack that just sort of takes the like sort of general story flow of the way that those games work and put it into a little story arc that was meant to sort of tell this like broad story over a period of years. And like, that was pretty cool. And he happened to plug another actual play podcast, Friends at the Table, that started at almost the same time as the Adventure Zone, but they play a lot of Power by the Apocalypse games. So I thought that sounded really interesting because the little I'd heard of the system from the Adventure Zone got me interested in it. So I checked out Friends of the Table, listened to a little bit of them playing their first campaign of Dungeon World. And I was very excited by the system. It just, particularly the way that the sort of back and forth structure of Power by the Apocalypse allows this like dynamic flow between the GM's NPCs and the player characters. And it just seemed a lot more dynamic than like D&D's rigid combat that I wasn't that much of a fan of. So I started looking into Dungeon World and all that. And before our group had actually played any other published game besides Dungeons and Dragons, I had worked together with my friend Ramona. You should follow her on Twitter at Ramona Starlight. She does art and stuff, and she helped me with world building and a little bit of illustration on Revenant World. But we worked together and we made this like really rules light little PBTA hack to emulate the world of Homestuck, the webcomic that we were both massively into in high school. So that was the first non-D&D game we played, was the little Homestuck PBTA hack that we put together. And we adapted that really bare-bones system. Again, it was mostly focused on, like, I hadn't fully absorbed all the different, like, aspects of the design philosophy of PBTA at that point. It was more just a focus on the way that the flow of narrative and gameplay between the GM and the players went. I just really liked that like feeling, that dynamism that it brings. So it was mostly focused on that, like just combat mechanics and then like simple checks for other stuff instead of like PBTA style moves, you know. But we used that little framework to play some other games. We did like a Percy Jackson hack with it, and we played that. So we were messing around with that before we ever brought another published game to the table. And we eventually brought Monster of the Week to the table, I believe, after the Adventure Zone started playing it. And then since then, we've been like branching out into more stuff, Forged in the Dark, all that other indie stuff. And I ended up taking what we had like started with the Homestuck PBTA hack, and that was like the original seed that I used to develop Revenant World. And I still worked together with Ramona on that. She helped me do some world building, like I said, as well as a couple illustrations for the book. And everyone helped play test that. And then, yeah, I put that out as my first published game in, I want to say, November 2018, I think. At the time, knowing like nothing about publishing, I had thought when I was writing it, like, oh, you know, if I wanted to publish this, I would have to find a company to publish it, right? But like that, you know, didn't pan out. And then I found out about DriveThruRPG and everything. I ended up laying out the game myself in Microsoft Word, I think, and, you know, put it out there myself. And it didn't make huge waves or anything, but everybody that I heard back from who had bought it and played it or read it gave me really positive feedback. So that really encouraged me to keep designing and to read all sorts of more games and absorb more game design lessons. Because I feel like you can kind of tell that Revenant World is like from somebody who, like, yes, is into the Powered by the Apocalypse thing, but has also definitely played D&D. So, but yeah, that's about how it started.
And how long have you been designing now for?
I guess that makes it I guess it's been 2.5 years since I put out Revenant World. Because Revenant World, that one took a while to come to fruition because I was sort of like just tinkering with it over a longer period of time. And like I said, I didn't even like have plans for laying it out and publishing it. Mm-hmm. And then my second game, Summers of 17XDX, came out a little quicker than that. It came out the next summer, I think. So that was less than a year between those. It was a little bit of a shorter game, a little smaller scope that was just doing some sort of experimental things with a GM-less engine that seemed neat. And then it again took a long while for my third big game, Arminerva, to come out, definitely in large part because of the pandemic. That really kind of squashed some of my creativity and my plans for like play testing. I was going to try to collect my own reference photography from places around here. I was unable to do that once everything locked down. So that really pushed our Minerva back a ways, but it eventually came out in March of this year. And I'm really happy with how it came out. I feel like there's like great leaps and bounds between each of my big releases. I feel like I keep absorbing so much more like great design juice from other games that I can then sort of reprocess into more exciting new things. And in between Summers of 17XDX and Arminerva, I put out a handful of Lyric games, which was a fun thing to dive into. And I definitely took some like lessons from that school of thought and put them into Arminerva. So yeah, So 2.5 years, I think, since I've been like seriously into designing, but there've been some fits and starts just because, you know, the way life can get in the way.
Truly, truly that life can make you pivot when you don't mm-hmm. want to pivot. Thank you. Thank you for sharing all that. Yeah. So you've been designing for ever since you started, ever since you finished your D&D campaign, kind of, sort of.
True. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean? Like,
yeah.
At some rate, every GM is a designer.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. I guess I don't have the... I don't have the dates for any of those things because they were just like personal projects that would definitely never see the light of day. So I don't really have, I don't, I'm not exactly sure how long there was between that like very first little PBTA hack and Revenant World. But I think it definitely took at least like a year and a half, maybe 2 mm-hmm. years there. I was still finishing up college and everything. So.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. And what'd you go to college for? I mean, you're still a person. I'd like to find out about you as well. I'm trying to do more intimate pieces here, if you're willing to share.
Sure, yeah. I did a business administration, which I suppose has been helpful to some degree with this mm-hmm. TTRPG stuff. And yeah, I've always been interested in like being able to like take things that I've made and like turn that into something that I can like sell to people, I guess. I think that mm-hmm. that just is like the most appealing career path to me. And I've, you know, throughout my life, I've like bounced around different things that I wanted to do in that vein. When I was a kid, I wanted to be a video game designer. And when I was in high school, I like tried to learn Unity and stuff. And I just could not wrap my head around coding. Like it was just, mm-hmm. it was just so opaque to me. Like, I know there's like so many good tutorials and so many people like teach themselves it, but I just could not wrap my head around that. So I guess sort of discovering TTRPGs was kind of like this really eye-opening thing. Like, wow, like I can create these like cool interactive experiences with these cool worlds that I have ideas for, and I don't have to code it in Unity. I can just tell people the rules and they have to execute them.
A guest that I had on previously for the show, Amber Seeger, we talked about, or I had mentioned how I think that humans are computers, like they're the operating systems, and how any tabletop game you learn or pick up is software that you're trying to download. And, you know, some software is written well for your operating system. Some is not. You have a certain amount of RAM to execute or hard drive to store, right? So you're basically doing video games just in, you know, word to brain formats rather than bytes to silicon. Is that... what are the innards of a computer? You know what I mean?
I wasn't able to figure it out. So, but yeah, I love that perspective. Yeah, that's great.
Well, let's talk about this banger of a game, shall we?
Thank you. Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Would you give a brief introduction of what Our Minerva is and sort of, you know, what you do as a player in it?
Absolutely. So Our Minerva is a GM-less slice of life game about the athlete children of undead gods. It's maybe my most out there, like, weird setting, very, like, weird philosophical, metaphysical stuff going on. I think I mentioned it's the sequel to my first game, Revenant World. Revenant World was a sort of, like, coming-of-age adventure game similar to, in genre, to Homestuck or Percy Jackson or, like, things like that. And it was about, like, kids from Earth going into a different dimension where there was these undead gods called Revenants that ruled over stuff, that ruled over the planets of the cosmos in this other dimension. And the Revenants in that game served as faction leaders and like important NPC allies and boss fights. So in Our Minerva, it takes place roughly 150 years after Revenant World. And the idea is that these Revenants have seized the sort of metaphysical engine that their progenitor gods used to create them and are now using it to create heirs for themselves. And you play as these heirs, these children of the Revenants. And the Revenants now pretty universally style themselves as the divine rather than Revenants. So you play as the children of the divine, and these characters are called, they're collectively called the Minerva, and a single one is called a Minervum. So it's sort of a little, I guess, wordplay off of like the Roman goddess Minerva, because the idea is that the name came from one of the divine referencing the story of Minerva, because the Minerva spring forth fully formed as like adult demigods, just like Minerva from the head of Jupiter. And then that it got like delineated into a plural of Minerva. But anyway, so you play as these Minerva, and the main thing, the main sort of role that the Minerva play in the world at this point in history is that they compete for glory for their divine parents in the sport arena. So they don't have a choice in the matter. They're consigned to compete in this violent sport. It's like a theming thing of, you know, the feelings of like parental expectations and the feeling like your life has been decided for you by someone else and all this stuff. And so as a player in the game, you play out the scenes in the sport. You're competing against the other players. It's GM-less. You're trying to score on each other in this arena. But the actual bulk of the game is, because the Minerva sprung forth fully formed, they never got to have like a childhood or a life that they ever got to self-determine, but they are these divine beings filled with this like divine power that's been like passed on from the old gods and everything in the lore. So while they're in sport, like experiencing these like intense emotions between each other and like fighting against each other and working with each other, in the most intense moments of a match, they enter into a like dreamlike flashback where they have a memory of slice of life interactions with their opponents on the field, except now they're like their friends that they're hanging out with at the mall or whatever. And then like you play through that slice of life interaction and sort of the like things that you learn about each other and your relationship with each other in this imagined past that you never got to live, then allows you to color how you get the upper hand in sport. So, and both phases of the game are played with a deck of playing cards. You have a hand of playing cards, and each suit represents a different sort of well of emotion that you can draw on. So in sport, you're like, the different suits are like, hearts is like your fighting spirit, you know, diamonds is your teamwork and camaraderie, clubs is disrupting the opponent's teamwork, and spades is like direct destructive violence. And then when you shift over to the town scenes, which are the slice of life scenes, hearts becomes friendship or romance. Diamonds becomes like, it's still sort of camaraderie or like teamwork, like sort of having a partnership with another person that's based on aiming towards a common goal. Clubs becomes, I believe it's like rivalry, jealousy. And then, yeah, rivalry, jealousy. Exactly what it says in the book. Great. and then spades is antagonism or hate. So yeah, and what you're trying to do with the cards is you have the hand of cards, and you're trying to move the cards from your hand to your rail, just like moving them like up the table to another line of cards. And then when you get them up in your rail, you're trying to add them together to create a face card. So in sport, when you create a face card, that means you get to score, and that activates the flashback to a town scene. And then in a town scene, whenever you build a face card, it means that you create a connection with another Minervum, which is like you guys sort of sync up and you like figure out something about how you relate to one another. You like get on the same page about your feelings, whether that's positive or negative or something confusing in between. And in sport, you're trying to move your cards from your hand to your own rail to build face cards. And in town scenes, you're trying to move cards from your hand to each other's rails to build connections with each other. So yeah, and then there's a third type of scene, duty scenes, which are little solo scenes, almost like a little like mini solo game sprinkled in there, where you can replace one of your town scenes with a duty scene where you sort of like pick from some prompts and describe an actual memory that your Minervum has of some other duty to their divine parent that they're carrying out off the field. So that might be like giving press interviews. That could be tending the temple of their parent. It could be doing a brand endorsement. It's very much this mix of like religious figurehead and brand icon. So yeah, that's sort of the gist of what players do. But there's all sorts of little subsystems that I'm very excited about and love to ramble about. There's like so you play with standard playing cards, but then there's abilities that you get that allow you to put little stickers over the pips on the cards. And then those let you use the card in a different way. So one of them makes it so that like someone else's ability can't steal one of your cards. One of them makes it so that the card is worth double when you're using it to like make a face card. One of them like flips the suit of the card, all sorts of stuff like that. And that gives it a sort of like legacy game feel to it, because you're putting these little stickers on your card that'll last between games and even, you know, between stories of like different characters, because every player makes a team of three Minerva, and you rotate between them each match which one you're focusing on. So the idea is that they're all there in the match, but you're sort of like spotlighting them for that episode, and then they're the one that gets to participate in the slice of life scene in this weird metaphysical dream memory world. But with there's a special sticker that you can put on one of your cards that adds the stars suit to the card. So it's a special suit in addition to the four. And that can allow you to do like that unlocks abilities that key off of like personal growth and progress. And additionally, if you're able to build the Joker card, which is called the Fool in the game, like the tarot card, you build that by having four cards that you've marked with a star and that all have the same value. And if you're able to use those to build the Joker card, then you get to end the story of one of the people on your team. And that's the part of the game that's like, it's described in very loose terms. It's like very open to interpretation of what sort of happens to them. It just basically says like, you know, they get to move on from this and like discover a new truth, like go on a new journey. And the game just tells you like, discuss this truth, discuss the truth of the Fool, and then retire them from the game, end the arc, and replace them with a new character. So you've got this rotating cast of the actual characters in the game, and the game's also designed to really accommodate a rotating cast of players, because it's like very episodic with the different, you know, each arc is over one match of the game. So it's very easy to drop in and out, and it can accommodate different numbers of players. I've really enjoyed playing it as a duet. That's always really fun. But then you can also have up to six players. And it's just, I really like the variety that it brings to being able to like switch things up and try out different pairings between characters, like have those slice of life relationship scenes between characters that like haven't talked yet before and everything. Like you've got this big cast to like do fun things with and explore and learn about who they are as characters and everything.
Let me tell you, there's tons to unpack there, for sure. I'm excited to get into all of it. The first thing, though, as I always ask for any of these, why make our Minerva? Why make a future or a sequel to Revenant World?
Yeah, I think I really enjoyed the world building of Revenant World. It was a lot of fun. Like putting together this very strange science fantasy world. But of course it was heavily inspired by like other media and everything. And I think I just wanted to take that world and like push in a completely different direction, look at a completely different set of characters, a different like kind of person in the world that still shares some like strong thematic elements with the main characters of Revenant World, and just like see it. And as well, like, take the same world and push it in a completely different mechanical direction and just like see what can come out of that. Even with the world building, I wanted to do the world building in a very different way, because Revenant World kind of has like this like kind of long chapter that like gives the GMs like all this information about the world and like stuff to build off of, little interconnected pieces to play with, which can be really useful for a GM'd game where like one person's coming up with like a sort of like background plot that the characters will intercede on. But with a GM-less game, it's a little bit harder to have like a lore dump, because everybody kind of has to be on the same page. So a lot of the like lore and setting elements of this game are like very like sprinkled throughout the like different locations that you'll play in, and everything's, I tried to keep things vague and evocative. I think that's a catchphrase of Dale Kingsmill, the D&D YouTuber.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Come on the show.
Yeah, you know, reach out to her. She might. But yeah, so I just really liked the chance to like take this world that I was really passionate about and then do something completely different with it and see how it looked. Like I think that was just like a very fun challenge, and like it's like a cool little thing for people who have played the first game, but then it's also super approachable if you haven't, because it's like so different. So basically, like the first page of the game is this like little sort of like stylized telling of what has happened in the 150 years since Revenant World. And then that's like, that's it. And then there's like not constantly referencing back like, oh, well, you won't understand what this is, but here's what it was in Revenant World. Like there's not really any of that. There's a lot of references to things from the world of Revenant World, but that will be like nice for fans to catch, you know, little Easter eggs, but it's nothing mm-hmm. that like a new person wouldn't understand, which I was kind of important to me, because you know it's a very different game. It might appeal to very different people. It's hard to say, but yeah. So I just think that was a fun direction to take the world that I had started building, and it's, I also just really like the idea of like taking a setting and then like, okay, what does that setting look like when something like huge in it changes, and like how different can the same setting be while still like keeping certain themes intact and having certain big players still around. That's always a lot of fun. And that's something that I've done a lot with my home games as a GM. There we had this one campaign where we played, it's been a while, I'm trying to remember exactly how it went. We had a little campaign of D&D that I GM'd. And then we had a sequel campaign where, like, because of the sort of, like, it was, like, there was, like, a time travel shenanigan and then some, like, weird, like, cataclysmic events with, like, multiple evil gods trying to destroy shit. But it ended up being that the sequel campaign we played in Blades in the Dark, because it was, like, oh, this city that was, like, part of the setting of the first game has now been like encased in this energy field, like the city in Blades in the Dark. And then, you know, crime is running rampant in it. And there's, you get to have these like daring scoundrels in it. And that like lets you shift into a completely different genre, and like big things in the world have changed, but it's still the same world. And it lets you have like fun little callbacks and references. And yeah, I'm just a big fan of that storytelling concept, I guess.
It sounds like all summed up, it's a matter of like you loved what you created in Revenant World, and you wanted to just sort of manipulate that clay into a different form. And I think that's fucking wicked. I think it's absolutely cool.
Thank you.
I love the Ara Minerva setting. I have a strange fascination with like the concept of the underworld, spirits, undeath, so it like hits some unique strings for me. And I'm becoming more and more enthralled with like the slice of life storytelling, or also like the coming of age stories as well. I think those are interesting to me too, because I watch a ton of anime, and a lot of the shonens are about that coming of age protagonist growth.
Yeah.
So, you know, some of my, the character creation process is very cool, like very, very cool. I love that it's almost like a, so as always, everyone, if you're listening to this, you're like, what is the full character creation process? I can only make this show like just about 90 minutes. So we probably won't get into every page of this game or exactly how every mechanic works, but I always recommend go buy the game, give it a little read, and then you can get some designer context, which is wicked cool. But the character creation process is really, I found it really fascinating that you went for this like troop style play for each player, where they each get 3 Minerva that builds their team, the sports ball. And I also like this duplicity of like the false memory concept of we didn't have a childhood or we didn't get to grow up. We are what we are now. And they're sort of self-creating these imagined instances. And I don't know if you're familiar with the anime Jujutsu Kaisen at all, but
I've heard of it, but I
that's okay.
I can't remember.
There's a character in there. His name is Toto, and he meets our protagonist. And Toto has this really strange character quirk where he asks what another like person's taste in a significant other is. And depending on their answer, he like gives them basically a thumbs up or a thumbs down in his brain. But when he finally gets a thumbs up from our protagonist, he has like this weird sweeping internal memory where they're mid like tournament arc fighting and he just transports to high school. And the protagonist is suddenly going to the same high school as him. And he reveals to the protagonist in this false memory that like he tries to tell the love of his life, like tries to confess his love to someone and she rejects him. And then like the protagonist is giving like a heartfelt, like, it's okay, man. And like in his brain, they've been brothers for forever. And he comes out of this memory. He's like, I finally met my brother. And it's like, what just happened? It's like the strangest character quirk I've ever seen come out of left field. But it's so cool.
That sounds exactly like our Minerva. That's wild.
Absolutely. And it's so crazy that like I'm reading this. I've seen that anime. I think the episode is like episode, if you don't care for context or want to watch the whole thing, or if you don't really like anime, I think it's like episode 12 or 13 where they fight and this moment happens. So if you want to give that a quick watch at some point during your day, I highly recommend it. It really comes out of left field. But I find it so interesting that there's this juxtaposition between these two sets of memories because, and additionally, like tack onto that, how you do this really rapid phase change for the game between the sport phase and the town phase, or even the duty phase. And I love what's also coupling this together and why I'm bringing this particular piece up is that the art style for the art version of the book that you provide a full text document version, but you also have a very beautiful, well done art version is this juxtaposition between the photography backgrounds and the illustration characters, almost like they're inserting themselves into a world that isn't really like for them. And that's a very cool parallel to draw there that I don't know if everyone gets when they look at it, but I got it immediately. I was like, oh wow, what brought it together for me was it's an image of a backseat of a car, and there's like a jock looking green skinned character just laying in the back seat that's so like it feels like the illustration is there and yet it doesn't at the same time, and it's a very interesting art piece that was really evocative for me, so that was very cool. But full circle back to character creation, I find it really interesting that you did this troop style character creation where I haven't played it yet. I've only read the game, so I'm in the theory mode of it until execution. Does character creation take a while depending on the number of players? Like, you're creating three characters for each player. So if you have four players or...
It does take a while, but it's also like the format is basically just that you're doing a personality quiz together.
Yes.
So like it can also like slap out like really quickly, especially like I really like how... In the character creations I've done, it's like you have the first question and you might sort of like hem and haw over it a little bit. And like you ultimately might even just pick like a random answer for it and play just whatever card is on top of your hand. But then like once you have that, then the table like starts talking about like, oh, like I'm starting to see what kind of character this guy is when we get to the second question. Okay, I've definitely got to pick this answer for the second question. Like, that's obvious. And then for the third question, like, oh, let's juxtapose that with this. And then that gives them, like, an interesting, like rounded character to them and everything. Like, now I'm really excited to play this guy. I hope I get him in the draft.
Yeah, yeah. And then you still draft them at the end. It's absolutely crazy and bonkers in terms of like what I've been exposed to in a character creation process. But I think it's really cool. And it's exactly as you say. I can also see a version in which like the character creation really becomes like it starts to accelerate, right? The first character maybe is like, honestly, probably really slow. Like everyone's like throwing some pieces onto this Minerva, but character two, character three, and then four is like feeling really quick because you have characters one, two, and three to really bounce off and create different pockets of story you want to tell, or maybe something that's not explored, or maybe you get a lot of, you want to explore some different choices. And what's also interesting about the character creation, because there's so many kind of pieces to this, I would find it rare, absolutely rare, to get a similar game between like two tables, right? Even if you're playing with like similar player circles, I would find it hard to find someone that says like, oh yeah, we did the exact same thing, because not only do you pick your, you're creating the Minerva, you also attach them to a parent god or a team, essentially, sort of their benefactor, which is also another piece of variable manipulation. There's just a lot of moving pieces, which is for me very cool. I love games like this because I like to have that work sort of like cut out for me of like who's in the story, and I don't really have to create a ton of NPCs or something. I like sort of the game to do it for me to some effect. Yeah. So it's very, the big word here is it's robust. It's a very robust character creation, and I think it does a lot of things well, and I don't think it misses at all.
Thank you.
But this is my bias.
The other thing that helps ameliorate the potential of like a long character creation is like I was saying, it's like very good for variable play groups. So even if you want to have six players in your campaign, you might do character creation where like players A and B get together and run character creations, and then players like C and D get together to run character creation. And then like, and then maybe like players, like, hold on, how many have I said so far? A, B, C players like E and F still need to make their characters. But then like players B and C can be like, oh, I want to help with the questions, even though I won't get to draft any of them, 'cause they're for you guys. Like we've done that a lot with our groups, is like, if some of us already have characters made and we want to bring someone else into the campaign, we'll still play character creation. And then it's just that only the new players get to draft out of the ones that we make. So that's always really fun.
You know, it's also really fascinating because you brought it up again in a different way, but you mentioned how you create sort of this legacy concept with the decks, right? With the stamping of the decks.
Yeah.
And you know what's really interesting? Because I know it changes between story, but there might be a hack in here somewhere, or maybe like an optional rule or something where you can, it's almost like a trading card game, right? Like TCG, where you could draft a team, pick from this group, and maybe there's a version of play where you don't do a character creation. You just bring your team to like another person who's played our Minerva. Mm-hmm. And like, oh yeah, I have a team that I drafted from my other circle of friends. You just want to play with the two of us and like have our teams clash. I think that'd be so fascinating. Yeah.
I think that it works like so well, because the only thing is just like, okay, it's just that these characters don't have personal history yet, but that's the whole theme of the game. So I jump in with them. It works great.
Yeah, I think it's really cool that I could bring like, oh shit, let me see. I don't want to look at the document. If I can bring a team of Crow Claws, right? Is that right? Is that a team in there? I think that's a team.
The Crow Claw 9 Black Falcons.
Yeah. Oh, I have to say the whole thing.
Well, no, I'm just saying
the whole damn thing.
The team is the Black Falcons. They're from the planet Crow Claw 9.
Damn it. Yes, the Black Falcons. That's some high Q energy out there for everyone who may have not seen that anime or not. That was the other thing too. I get a lot of like sports anime energy from this, both the sort of slice of life ones like High Q or Hajime no Ippo, but then I also get like sort of the super subtle superpowered ones like Prince of Tennis or Kokoro no Basketball. Those are really interesting touch points for me personally when I saw this. And I also get, I guess I have to ask you, you seem really influenced by like the young adult fantasy sort of style fiction. You mentioned Percy Jackson earlier. I got a lot of that from reading R. Minerva. I also get like some Degrassi energy with the town phase stuff. Is that just something that like you're so enamored by that it kind of fits into all of your games to date?
Yeah, it doesn't come up in everything. Like, I don't think there's really any of that energy in like Summers of 17XDX, but that's definitely like throughout high school and middle school too, I guess I was super, super into like young adult, like, you know, coming of age adventure stuff, you know. Percy Jackson is still my favorite, but you know, other stuff, there's like, you know, 39 Clues, even Harry Potter, which has now been ruined for us, but you know, all sorts of stuff. And even now, like I really enjoy reading young adult books, even though I'm not the target audience anymore, because they're just, you know, I think that they're still relatable. I was a young adult, and they're just really fun, you know. That I branch out and read other stuff now too, but I've still got a big soft spot for YA fiction. And of course, I mentioned Homestuck before. Was massively into that in high school, and that's you know, not a novel, but still like has very strong like YA adventure energy. So yeah.
I love it. I feel the same way. I watch a ton of shonen anime. They are what they are. It's about a kid that gets superpowers and tries to learn the responsibility of those. Not a ton of things break that formula. I'm here to eat the popcorn and enjoy it. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, it's a very cool thing. It's just something I enjoy.
Don't fix what ain't broke.
That's what I'm saying. So for, like you mentioned earlier, there are a ton of subsystems inside of our Minerva, especially since you're using playing cards, which is another boon for me. I want to see way more playing card style games. I know that dice are hot, and a lot of people think that like D6s are super accessible, but they're not. I think there's always a playing card deck in a house. You've played Go Fish, you've played War, you've played Slapjack, you've done a bunch of things. Have some poker, Texas Hold'em games at your house.
And I mean, like, people are, like you're saying about the D6s, people are like, oh, everybody has a D6. But it's like, yeah, everybody has like a D6 in their Monopoly set. They don't have the pool of D6s that you need for a bunch of dice pool games, and they can get them just as easily as a set of polyhedral dice. I think, at least, like, we have Amazon now. You can get any set of dice you need for a couple bucks. But everybody has a deck of playing cards, at least, I feel like. So,
run down your local Walgreens and just pop in and buy a pack, right? Yeah. Like, you don't need to find a specialty. Well, I guess Walgreens also sell, I think I've seen it, sell five dice or some shit of D6s or whatever. But just in case that's not true for all Walgreens out there, it's really easy to go into like a gas station or something and pick up a deck of cards, as opposed to like trying to find a hobby store or wait for your Amazon order. Like, you can crunch out a deck of cards if you need to. So, but I love the affordances you give to a lot of, like, it's a ton of work you've put into this book to come up with prompts for every single suit and number combination, in addition to coming up with the two different sets of phases for all the suit combinations and the counter system for the sports side of the phase. Like, there's some nice gambling elements in there. Why I bring it up is, like, were there any particular like mental hurdles or struggles or challenges in any portion of the design? Like, what was the most challenging bit for you when you were writing this game?
That's a good question.
What had the infinite hamster wheel turning? I just don't understand what I'm doing here. Or was there like a darling you had to cut that you wish you could have kept, but it just didn't make sense for this game?
I do kind of have one of those. I'm like looking through the table of contents, seeing if there's something that I remember really struggling with. Cause I mean, something that always like trips me up a little bit is anytime there's like currencies, be they like literal or just like different, like,
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Like economies within the mechanics, if you know what I'm saying.
Resources and stuff.
It's always hard to figure out, like you kind of just have to take a wild guess at like how much of a resource you should give to people and how much everything should cost until you like do the first play test. And like, you know, not, I feel like I've, you know, seen some conversation about this around and everything that like, you, not every game needs to be play tested and everything. And I, you know, totally agree with that. I don't think everything has to be like tested out to death, but like for me personally, I feel a lot more comfortable with something that I'm like mathing out like that, where it's like, all right, I just need to guess it and then get it on the table. Cause I can't figure this out just in my head. So like there was a lot of tweaking with like how big the hand size should be, how much Brio you get from different things, how much Brio the different abilities should cost. But like at some point you sort of like, you get the feel for it and then you can like fill out the rest of the stuff, which is, it's always nice to have that little breakthrough, I think. But in terms of a darling that I had to cut, there's this concept that I guess now like twice I've thought that I was going to use it and then I don't. I had a lot of different ideas for Armor Never Owners in its very like early stages. You know, I was being inspired a lot by like Lyric games and stuff. And I was like, okay, so like a big part of this game is that you have these like slice of life things where you're going to like different local spots and sort of just like enjoying each other's company or, you know, getting really mad at each other or whatever you're doing there, but you're still, you know, enjoying sort of a public space that you can hang out in. So I had this idea that like, what if some aspect of the game, oh no, I remember how this actually started. One of my very first mechanical ideas for the game was that it would have some sort of fantasy football component where some sort of statistic or resource that you had in the game was based on something outside of the game. Like how in fantasy football, you get the points for how the players that you chose do. So I was thinking about having it literally be based off fantasy football things, like you know, play fantasy football and the points you get convert to stats or cards or something. But that ended up seeming a bit daunting. And then when I was thinking of the like more lyrical stuff and the stuff about the slice of life, I was like, what if you get like bonuses from, there's a specific word. What are they called? It's a certain type of game. It's a, Oh my God, I can't. It's a game. It's at least like adjacent to Lyric Games, and they're like games that you play just while going through your everyday life. Are they pervasive games? I don't know if that's right. Someone will know.
Well, I think Jian Shim makes some games that are like this.
Yeah, well, whatever they're called, I'm sure somebody will let us know. Yeah, I was getting ideas from that, and I was like, oh, what if instead of like it being based on a fantasy football, what if you get points in the same style for like doing things in your day-to-day life that are like just going out and enjoying things, like taking photographs of like flowers or like cool things that you see on the road or like just various stuff like that. But then, you know, in addition to that, like potentially being a little bit daunting to incorporate into a game that has like a bit more crunch to it, instead of just having that stand on its own as like a cool experience, the pandemic happened. And then I was like, oh, well, people can't do that. So like, oh, no. I can't even do that. So that got cut. And then the game I'm working on now, I had the thought again. I was like, oh, what if for this game, because I'm working on a game now that like one of the mechanics is like looking at like a big illustrated map and like pointing things out on it. And I was like, what if there's an additional mechanic where if you take photographs in real life or find cool photographs on the internet, you can like bring those in and use it as a like landmark, the same way pointing things on the map is. But, at least with the current draft I have now, that once again did not get incorporated into the final gameplay concept. So one of these days I'm going to have a game where you like go out and take photographs of stuff. And then that lets you do cool things in the gameplay when you're at the table. Cause I really like that general idea of having a thing to do away from the table that gives you a benefit at the table. I think that's a really fun thing, because there's even in really traditional games, like take Pathfinder or something, like a really crunchy traditional game, people talk a lot about how building characters and like planning out your upgrades and stuff, whether it's for a campaign that you're actually playing or one that you hope to play one day, is like a major part of the game. Like you're playing when you do that. And like, that's one of the big appeals of the game, is that you have lonely fun. I've heard it called. So I just like the idea of taking that, like ways to think about the game away from the table, and like having that turn into an explicit mechanic rather than like an implicit emergent one, like it is in that case. So yeah, I think that's a neat idea. I'm pretty sure I saw a while back Nem from Sandy Pug Games talking about a similar thing. I think they incorporated that idea into Renesistance, I think, is the one where when you're away from the table, you like build a playlist that then like does cool stuff in the game. I think that's the right game. Yes, this is the right game. In Renesistance, you play as a gang of revolutionaries using real-life music playlists to cast powerful magic and fight an ongoing street war against the fascist forces of Neo-Kletgau. I don't know if that's how you say that. But yeah, so that's just that sort of idea of like putting things together away from the table that have a sort of that whole concept of like building mechanics, explicit mechanics for being away from the table, that like, because you know, it's sort of a part of playing a TTRPG campaign is thinking about the TTRPG campaign when you're not actually at the table, especially when you have trouble scheduling, as lots of us do. So yeah, I haven't quite found a way to make a mechanic like that work yet, but it's something that I keep thinking about.
There is an idea I had a while back that was similar in vein of using your town, like going out and getting a map of your town, like a road map or something like that, and marking like different cool locations you think are cool in the town, and then doing like a sort of trad adventure Shadowverse version of that. Ooh. So like it's almost like the anime Persona, like Persona 5 or 4, how there's a lot of negaverse versions of things, of people and or locations, which I think would be really interesting. So like, for example, I live in Cleveland and we have like the Terminal Tower. And, you know, I think of a version where you could play at home and just like, yeah, Terminal Tower, put a picture in it. What does that look like? But I also think of a version where like the mechanics are light enough that you could go to the Terminal Tower play and do like sort of like a real time situation, which would be cool.
Could be almost like a LARP hybrid type thing.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, I definitely had a little bit of that thought with Arma Nerva too. Cause like a big thing about all the town locations is that they're all places that exist right here where I live that are either like actual hangout spots. It's a mix between like hangout spots and then locations that are sort of like in the background of your day to day when you're walking around the town that like you never really look into unless like someone you know works there or whatever, like the factory district, the laboratory. I have no idea what they do at the big laboratory campus down the street. So that makes it sort of like, that makes it like mysterious and interesting. And so like, that's why that one was included. But since there are locations that are like right here, I definitely had the thought of like, oh, how could I do it where it's like, when you go to the location, you go there in real life. But, but the way that the mechanics ended up working out with like you mentioned earlier, the sort of like quick flipping between different scenes and different locations and stuff, like going like from sport to a town location to sport to a different town location. It just didn't end up working for this version. Yeah. But I love that idea. That's even like you said, just using like a map of your hometown to run like Voidheart Symphony or something, you know, like a Persona style game. That would be so cool.
It'd be wicked, wicked sick. Yeah. Yeah. I definitely, and like you could play at your favorite diner, a park trail, something like that. How hard is it to carry like, I don't know, a deck of cards or dice with you or something, then a little dice box if it really came down to it. But what does, and it, the other thing that's interesting about that thought too, is like, if you could figure out a game that wasn't quite a LARP, was a little bit more like a tabletop. Cause I'm sure whatever we're talking about right now is some sort of LARP game that neither of us have been exposed to. But what does different like season or weather look like when you try to play this game, right? You don't, I think there'd be an interesting way of like, is it raining outside? Go find a shelter somewhere and play in the rain or whatever. Yeah. I think would be cool. Maybe like provide some form of like laminated character sheet or whatever, or something you can use with your phone. Well, rain. Whatever. Yeah, I think there'd be something really interesting there.
What if like, I can imagine like probably like a very like light, like lyric style game where like you print out a sheet and then you do like play it in the rain and where the raindrops fall on the sheet does things. Like how cool would that be?
Ooh. Gotta get people a laminator though. Well, I guess you could sell it in the book. Well, I know there's like, sorry, my mind's in business mode of like, okay, now how do I get people like the proper material to execute this idea? Is it a whiteboard? Do I send them a whiteboard? You know?
I've got a little laminator, like a single page laminator.
Do you want to laminate for every person that buys that game?
I don't know. I don't know.
Are you in the business of lamination now?
As long as not too many people buy the game, it's fine.
It's got a cap. It's got a cap on the limited edition. Arma Nerva is really, I think it does some really interesting things with the kind of task switching of the imagination playground. I think is what all this chatter is leading me towards, that there's a really cool instance of having the high octane action of the sport phase and then having sort of like the surreal imaginary slice of life that is the town phase. And if you're really like jonesing to find out a little bit more about your own personal character, you have the duty phase that you can commit to, right? And that's the, you know, for people, just to prove that I read the game, duty phase is basically like what you're basically the spokesperson for your parent, right? Mm-hmm. And it's also being like a sports celebrity in a little bit of a way as well. Yeah. So, you know, putting on a cool outfit or going down the red carpet or any of those scene instances. Because I also imagine those young adult like montages, especially when it's like a, either like a rich teen or like a popular teen or something like that, of flashbacks to like signing someone's autograph, like a famous actor in your school or some ish like that. Those definitely like remind me of those sorts of moments. And mm-hmm. especially in like anime, as I've seen, like Sailor Venus is a great example from like the Sailor Moon series of someone who's like both an idol and also a superhero and is living like this double life, but also trying to put up like prop up her own brand while making relationships with her friends. So yeah, I think you've done something really cool in the storytelling department for this. And then on top of that, you've also got some very cool like subsystems. Like I love the sort of like almost, it's almost like a sort of Magic the Gathering feel of the stack, the like spell stack for the counter phase, like when you're trying to score a point during the sports phase and how you're like doing either the hard counter or the under counters and you're trying to like bait out cards from your, or you can bait out cards from your spot, if you will, while you are the drive or the, or vice versa as well. I think that it's all, I think there's, it's brimming with tech and it's like a big game. Like I would consider this like a big written game. There's lots of prompt energy. There's lots of affordances for all of the cards you use, all the questions you have for character creation. Like you have written a lot in this.
Thank you. Yeah, I really like you mentioned that it like it really has like a competitive card game feel. And like I definitely didn't want to go like full card game, you know, because that just that requires like so much like play testing and like math knowledge and everything to make it work out. But like it's still like I really like how it really does feel like that phase really does feel competitive between everybody. It gives it like this very cool, like what's the, I'm looking for that term that people find pretentious and don't like, ludonarrative synergy. It gives it a ludonarrative synergy there that I like, because, you know, you're like, especially when every time I've played with my boyfriend, he's always like so competitive in the sports space. Yeah. And then you get like pulled out of it. And it's like, okay, now you have to be friends now. And it's sort of like, it's like, you know, I really like the way that like it gives you those different sort of like vibes between the different phases and everything.
I was going to say, I think what's interesting about that, too, is you've captured this really interesting, like, back and forth energy, not just between, like, the sports phases and questions, but also, like, the pacing of the sports phase and the town phase. Like, it feels like a sport in the sense that truly anything could happen, like, anything could turn the tide. And so you're watching an offensive play go off in a football game and suddenly, you know, a bad toss, enemy team receives. And now the whole thing is flipped on its head and the energy in the stadium has shifted. Mm-hmm. And so I find it really fascinating that you've captured that on a mini level and on a macro level for the game.
Thank you. Yeah, I like the thing that I like that I'm like most happy with the game is just like, how, at least with all the groups I've played it with, like how well it flows. 'Cause it's like, it's pretty structured. It's like turn-based through like every phase, but like, because it uses the sort of popcorn initiative, I think it's called, where it stays feeling dynamic. You're like always having choices. And then like, you have like a lot of control over the pacing of your turn because it doesn't feel like you're just waiting for your turn because of like the way it plays out, I think. 'Cause like the way that the different steps of the turn are like a setup and like a scene setting and then like a burst of action and maybe like a little back and forth of defense. Like I guess it maybe captures a little bit of the like spirit of what I really liked with the Powered by the Apocalypse back and forth, but with like very different underlying mechanics. And I was very happy with how, you know, that works with the sports action scenes. And then it worked to me surprisingly well with the slice of life scenes. Like I was kind of worried that putting so much structure into a scene that's literally just about like hanging out and figuring out if you're friends or if you're pissed at each other or what would like feel overbearing or make it feel unnatural. But like from what I've played, it like really helps people like get into a really cool role playing back and forth that like really feels like it pulls you into this structure of a slice of life scene where there are like, you know, there's not any big stakes, but it's still like, we want to know what happens to these characters and we want to know how they're interacting with each other here. So I'm really happy with how that turned out.
Yeah. And, you know, for the listeners at home, not to get too into it, but like some of the town scenes have little mini game draw phases in them. Are you driving a car? What movie are you seeing? I don't want to get into the table, but you better go read the book. Any last bits you want to leave for our Minerva before we shift into a new topic here, Clove?
Sure. I did want to highlight that with the duty scenes, the ones I wanted to just mention sort of like the thing that got me thinking about that is that the entire concept of all the different duty scenes was built around the fact that I really wanted a mechanic where you get to describe like a wild red carpet outfit. That was the whole, that is the one duty scene that then made me make the 15 other duty scenes, I think. So yeah, I just really wanted to have that. Possibly, I think that focus might have been a bit inspired by the way that a lot of times on Friends of the Table, a lot of the players will talk about different outfits from different fashion shows that they say that their characters are wearing and stuff. And I just find that really fun. I think the whole thing of like the moment in a game where you stop and you're like, wait, what cool outfit is your character wearing? I just really wanted to have like a mechanic where you have to do that and you have to give us some details and like, yeah. And then similar thing for the town mini games, like you mentioned, a handful of them have mini games. And the one mini game that I really wanted to have in there is the local restaurant mini game where you get to order something on the menu. I thought that was just so fun. I love in like a JRPG or whatever, if you go to a restaurant, you get to order like normal food, but then it gives you like extra magic or extra health or whatever.
Yeah.
Like that. I really think that that's like a fun thing, especially because like, you know, that really lines up with the like combination slice of life and like, supernatural action thing. That's like a thing in Persona and everything. So I really wanted to have that. And that menu is actually based pretty directly, both in aesthetic and the items that are on it, from my actual favorite local restaurant here. And I don't know if I should give them a shout out because like, I don't know for sure if the people that own it are like cool people, I guess. Maybe vet them before doing that. But yeah, that was the inspiration for that. And one of my like favorite tiny mechanics in the game is that, so like with the character creation we talked about, it's, you know, you're answering like personality quiz questions essentially, except they're all geared towards being like a weird supernatural athlete celebrity. And the answers that you pick give you your character's tendencies, which are both like, they're basically like tags, like in Fate or something that you can like invoke in the town scenes, but they also each have a unique skill tree attached to them. And you unlock parts from that skill tree in the same style as like a MOBA game, where every match you start with none of them. And then you get to choose which path on the skill tree you unlock throughout the match. So I really like that mechanic, but that's not what I was bringing up. To wrap back, the only way to give an existing Minervum that you've already created and been playing as an entirely new tendency, you can only do that through that local restaurant mini game. You have to order the local bottle of wine, which is the most expensive thing on the menu. And that's the only way to add an extra tendency to your character. And I just, it's like really silly, but I just really like that that's the mechanic for that. It just feels very fun and idiosyncratic to me.
I love it because it reminds me of like, you have to do this really specific, I don't know if you've mentioned JRPGs, but I don't know if you play like Final Fantasy X. There is a mini game you have to do to get one of the secret weapons where there's a planes of lightning that like it rains lightning bolts every once in a while on the planes. And you have when you get hit by it, you lose health, but even if you're not in an encounter, but you can click a button to reaction dodge it. You have to dodge 300 of these lightning bolts to unlock this character's secret weapon. And it just reminds me of like these really extreme side quest things, like small, like hidden Easter eggs, or like you have to do an entire, like it's not part of the main game, but you have to fight all the monsters in the arena to unlock this item. Like, I think that's really interesting and very cool.
It kind of ties into the idea. I mean, it's not exactly the same thing because, like, you know, like having it be like a thing that you almost discover in a location in world is a little bit different than the thing I'm about to say. But I've been seeing a lot of talk recently about putting achievements in tabletop role playing games. And I love that idea. I know they're doing it in Monster Care Squad. I've seen a couple other mentioned that I can't bring to mind right now, but I think that's a really fun idea. And I might have to do that for the game I'm working on right now because it's a game based on FPS games. So like, got to have achievements in that, right?
Yeah. Yeah. 10 headshots, same round, killing it. Give me that MVP award. Play of the game. Give me play of the game. Doing a new thing on the show recently. I know I talk about trends and tips after we talk about the game a little bit, but I also open the floor to the guests talk about, because I want to treat the show as a forum for the guests to speak rather than myself, because I'm here to learn, not talk. I've been asking guests recently to bring up topics that they want to talk about in our industry, in our space, or for themselves, or something like that. So Clove has brought to the attention of how to go from a sort of no budget business plan to do tabletop games. And this is in contrast to, on this show, we talk a lot about Kickstarter. We talked a lot about itch funding or alternatives to Kickstarter. And this is just sort of like another piece of the puzzle outside of those two things. So Clove, why don't you sort of open up, what did you mean when you brought that topic up to me?
Yeah. So, yeah, I think that, you know, as you say, you talk a lot about Kickstarters and, you know, alternatives to Kickstarter, which are, I think are all like great. It's like crowdfunding is like a great opportunity to be able to get like a budget that you normally need some sort of like publisher, some sort of gatekeeper to get. But I just think that doing a crowdfunding effort can be very daunting and very stressful. Mm-hmm. And then if you have these like big plans where like you want to like hire a certain amount of people and all this stuff for your project and you need to crowdfund for it, and then you don't hit your goal, like your project kind of falls apart potentially, or you have to like massively scale it back. So I think like if you don't feel up for that responsibility, and it's also a huge responsibility to run a project like that, and you got to, you know, deal with the backers and all that. So I think that it's just important for people to realize that like when they hear about all that stuff, it's a great option if it sounds good to you. But if that sounds stressful to you, that like you don't need to fund it all. You can make an entire TTRPG on like essentially a $0 budget. My first couple games, the only money I spent on them at all was ordering print proofs of the print on demands. And that's it. So my first game, Revenant World, I mentioned earlier, it's not the most impressive layout or anything. It's a little bare bones, but I did the layout in Microsoft Word. You know, that there's like, you can do your layout in a word processor if you don't feel confident with layout tools. But even if you want a more robust option, there's free layout options or like very affordable ones. Our Minerva I laid out on the web-based tool Canva, which it can be finicky. It has limitations compared to something like an Adobe product or whatever, but that also means it's a lot more streamlined. It's less daunting to learn, which is why I went for it, because I do have access to a Creative Cloud account with Adobe because my mother works in the school system, so she gets it. But I just wasn't at the time prepared to learn a whole new Adobe product because they're so complex. And there's all sorts of tutorials and stuff for them if you want to go through that. But I just was not ready to learn a new tool like that. And I saw someone online recommend Canva. It's 100% free. It's really easy to use. It has free stock photos built in and stock assets, which are great. Like that's another great free asset that you can have. And then there's just, you know, alternatives to Adobe that are, you know, cheaper than Adobe, because Adobe is preposterously expensive, especially if you don't have some sort of school account. So I think there's like, I've heard a lot of talk about Affinity. I'm not well versed in those tools because I've you know, like I said, I haven't endeavored to learn complex tools at this point. But I think that's another good point, is that like, you may feel like you have to hire a layout artist, and that can be a great resource. That can be like a great partnership in the scene. But if that's daunting to you, you can make something that looks good in the free software that's like very intuitive and doesn't require you to watch 100 hours of YouTube tutorials to figure it out. And then the other really great resource that I had for our Minerva is the website Unsplash, which has stock photography released under a custom license called the Unsplash license, which is similar to CC0. It's a non-attribution license. I think the only restriction on it is that you can't just like sell a poster of the images you download. You have to use it in something else. But otherwise, it's like very open. So like all of the photographs in the book in our Minerva are from either Unsplash or from Canva's free asset library. And then I did do the illustrations for all of my games in Photoshop, which, it, as mentioned, preposterously expensive. But there's like tons of great cheaper free alternatives to that too. I can't remember the name, but I saw recently on Twitter someone posted that there was an in-browser tool that recreated one for one all of the features of Photoshop.
Yeah, so it's called P something. I'll put it in the show notes. It's all right, like great. Photo P or something like that.
Yeah, so that sounds fantastic. I don't even know how you do that, because like how do you even run Photoshop in a browser? Photoshop takes up a bunch of my system resources. But you know, that's a great free alternative. I can't remember at this point which of the other tools are premium and which are free, but they're pretty much all cheaper than Photoshop at any rate. Like Clip Studio Paint or like ToolSci or something. But yeah, sorry, what were you saying? What did you say?
No, I was just saying, in addition to the softwares you've been using, if you want like an Illustrator alternative, there's also Inkscape that's out there that you can run. And then there's also GIMP, which is another Photoshop alternative.
Right, yeah. So yeah, and like you can, if you just Google like Adobe alternatives, there are like infographics that'll give you like 10 different options for every single product in the Adobe suite. So yeah, and then like if you, I guess one of the other big like hurdles towards doing something on zero budget is that like not everybody is an illustrator. Like I feel like I'm kind of lucky. I've just been drawing since I was a little kid, so I've got some level of mastery enough that I can do my own illustrations. But you know, you you don't need bespoke illustrations necessarily in your game. There's tons of great, like, not even, even there's tons of games that people love that have hardly any illustrations that are laid out super plainly. But even beyond that, if you want like a very like art book looking game, you can use that stock photography. You can use, there's like CC0 libraries of like old paintings and stuff, which are fantastic. Mm-hmm. I think I've seen Keegan EXE using a lot of like that sort of stuff, like just like old illustrations that have no copyright on them. You just put them in your game. You can find them of like almost anything to fit whatever the theme and aesthetic of your game is. And then when you go to publish it, like I mentioned before, when I started out, I was publishing on DriveThruRPG. You just throw your stuff up there. I'm not as much of a fan of DriveThruRPG anymore since I've discovered Itch. Itch.io has a lower default cut that they take from you, and you don't have to give them a cut at all. It's completely adjustable, and they just have a much sleeker interface. It's way easier to use. I still host a DriveThruRPG page. I still put up my big games on there just because it has
another good audience.
Yeah, it has good SEO. It has its own discoverability and stuff. So I never promote to there, and I just get a few random sales a month from people that completely organically discover the stuff on DriveThruRPG, even though like, so it's basically no work to like, you know, you do a little work to put it up once, and then, you know, you can get some zero effort sales there, I guess, because it drives its own traffic. And then you can put your energy into advertising on the platform you prefer. And then if you want to publish a physical copy, what I did for my first couple games, I don't have these editions available anymore. I still haven't figured out like what I'm going to do with physical editions of my old games moving forward. But when they launched, I had them on Amazon through Amazon's Kindle Direct Publishing is what it's called. It's branded with Kindle, even though it's physical books. But that's another one where the interface can be a little clunky. It can have weird uploading errors that are hard to diagnose. But once you get it up there, they just handle everything for you. And you can just tell people, hey, my book's on Amazon. That's a really... It's unfortunate to have to go through Amazon just because of like who they are as a business. There's no denying that it's like super accessible to potentially a larger audience. Like depending how you advertise and like who you're trying to get to buy your game, it could, like, if it's somebody who isn't like big into the indie scene, it feels like it can be easier to be like, oh yeah, just hop on Amazon and get it. You already have an Amazon account. You have Amazon Prime. You can get my book through Amazon Prime versus like, all right, you got to go on this website called DriveThruRPG. I know the website looks like it hasn't been updated since the year 2000, but trust me, it's safe. And you have to make an account, and then you have to select the print on demand option. Yeah. So that can be kind of a hurdle. But, you know, that is still a good point, though. DriveThruRPG also offers print-on-demand. I've heard the uploading, and I've taken a look at it a little bit, and I've heard other people talk about it. The uploading process to that print-on-demand service is even clunkier than Amazon's, like, by a lot. So that's a little unfortunate. But it's there. You can find tutorials to help you figure out how to do it. And, so that allows you to basically... Because those are print-on-demand options, it gives you the ability to have your book perpetually available for as long as you want to have it available, and you don't have to buy any stock to start with. You don't have to handle the shipping to anybody. You just list it up there, and then you get the royalties from it. I feel like I had another note on that, but I'm not sure. That's all right.
That's all right.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mentioned that my one cost was print-on-demand proofs, which is just when you first set up your book, you can, before you push it live, you can order a copy that will show you what the copy will look like when it goes out to other people. You technically don't have to do that, but it's probably a good idea to do that in case there was any catastrophic issue you didn't notice. But usually those copies come to you like at cost, like you don't have to pay the distributor's like portion of it, you know, so that can be relatively cheap, especially if you're doing paperback, especially if you're not doing a book that's hundreds and hundreds of pages. So yeah, that is, those are all like great resources for doing things completely no cost. For Our Minerva, I went a little more all out with the physical editions because I was having trouble finding a print on demand route that could print such a big book in the format that I wanted it, because it's like 525 pages. I kind of needed it to be hardcover because softcover just doesn't work that well with that many pages.
Yeah.
And I had designed it with, I had laid it out with this square format in mind. So it had to find services that could do the square book and everything. So I ended up, instead of doing print on demand, I just have it where you can buy it direct from my itch page, because they let you set up physical rewards and like ask people for an address and stuff. And I just maintain like a very small stock here at home, because like I'm still printing them on demand from the service where I have it set up, if that makes sense. I just don't have it listed for people to buy it directly from there. That service I ended up using is Lulu. That's the easiest setup of a book I've ever done and the highest quality book I've ever had printed. Ooh. So I recommend them. They are a bit pricey, and because Our Minerva is such a huge book and I didn't opt to do like an offset print run, that means that the books are quite expensive. It's like a very positioned as a very premium, like boutique product, because that's just what it needed to be as nice as I wanted it to be. But yeah, I think Lulu's good. And Lulu does have like a print on demand storefront that you can list stuff on. But with how expensive the printing costs turn out to be for these books, for them to list it on their storefront and then also have to take their cut from it would have made it even more expensive than I'm selling it for on my itch. So I didn't opt to put it up with that. I'm just handling the shipping for the first time ever, which has been interesting.
International stuff you had to deal with yet?
Not yet. I have it listed on the itch page of like where it's like the cost includes US shipping. If you need international shipping, message me so I can tell you how much to add to the thing. So I haven't had to deal with that yet, but hopefully it won't be too much of a hassle.
Yeah. Those are all beautiful tips. And I think that in a lot of our Kickstarter / Patreon models or crowdfunding models, or all of our crowdfunding alternatives, I think sometimes we can, what is the phrase? Lose sight of the forest and the trees. Is the other way around? Lose sight of the trees and the forest. I remember. I'm not good at phrases.
Yeah. What? Now I'm confused which way it is. I thought I knew it. miss the forest for the trees. Is that it?
Yeah.
Okay.
That you can like, honestly, just put up a product and call it a day. You know what I mean? Like you can make a thing, put it up, and then it's done. You don't have to you don't have to think of a stretch goal. You don't have to think of like an enhancement goal per like itch funding things. And you can just do that. That's also an option. And sometimes even I forget about that. Like, oh, I should totally like itch fund this, or like I could do that. But like, or I could just charge $10 for this and call it a day. Just be done. This is what it is.
And it feels good to be like, all right, I finished my game and now I've published it and now that's finished. Now I don't have another 30 days of running the Kickstarter and then like managing all the funds and all that stuff. I finished it and now it's out there and people can get it and it's great.
Yeah.
One potential downside, which is also, I think has been discussed as a downside of itch funding, is that Kickstarter can offer a marketing push that like itch funding can't match. And I don't have a great solution to that with like a zero budget game. You know, the most effective marketing I've figured out is just talk to people about your game, post about it, post about other people's games that you like, you know, talk to people whose games that you like and see if they like your games. And That's as best as I've figured it out so far.
Build up the circle. Yeah. Come on to the Draw Your Dice podcast. You know, whatever.
Absolutely. So, yeah.
Well, I think that's a beautiful set of topics, and all those, maybe all those. I don't know what the show notes are going to look like for this one in particular. There's a ton of cool people and resources that are on this list right now. And I'm like, man, this is like 20 things. Are people going to actually like go to all these? So I'll do some vetting of those and put up some really cool ones, like to the primary of this episode, probably stuff like Inkscape and Canva and everything like that. All the $0 resources. But I think with that, you've pretty much covered like both a trends thing and a tips thing all in one go, because you sort of talked about the trend of crowdfunding and sort of a tip of like, hey, what if not crowdfunding, you know? And I think that's going to bring us to the top of this show. We're at almost 145 minutes. 145 minutes? That is not how you read time, Jeremy. An hour 44. Jesus Christ. Hey, Clove, why don't you take us out by telling people where they can find you, get in touch with you again, feel free to plug anything again. Again, all of these notes will be down below in the show notes for your access to get in touch with Clove.
Absolutely. So, yeah, my Twitter, again, is @CloveRPG, real simple. And if you only want to see promotional tweets, that's @RevenantWorld. And my itch page is vagabondpenandpaper.itch.io. That's, of course, and spelled out. Vagabondpenandpaper.itch.io. I also have the DriveThruRPG store, but like I said, I don't try to push people towards that because it already hogs the SEO when you Google Vagabond Pen and Paper. It already comes up above the itch. So I'm hoping I can... I'm hoping the itch one will overtake it at some point. So everybody search Vagabond Pen and Paper and click on the itch link to boost that SEO for me.
Send them clicks.
And any other like places that you would find me would end up being linked from my itch page and my Twitter @CloveRPG. So that wraps it up.
Amazing. Well, everyone, thank you for sitting down and joining us today. I had an absolute blast talking with Clove about a really amazing game. I hope you've had a good time as well, and we will catch you in the next episode. Say bye to the people, Clove.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye. All right, that's a wrap. Thank you for taking the time to sit down and hang out with Clove and I. We really appreciate it. You can find links and resources down below in the show notes, such as getting in touch with Clove or other episodes with similar topics. If you want to be a part of the conversation, please come and join the community Discord server. Also, make sure to subscribe to the Draw Your Dice Patreon, where you can get access to early releases of episodes from as soon as we interview. Thanks again for stopping by. And as always, I will catch you next time.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.